This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about the relationship between religion and climate change in America. We'll find out how religion has affected beliefs around the climate crisis and its impact on how climate change is addressed. To learn more, we're joined now by Peter Tusin, professor of religious studies at IUPUI, and Gabe Filippelli, executive director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Peter, I'll start with you. How did you become interested in the relationship between religion and climate change? I never would have thought of combining these two topics.
Well, I've been interested in the weather since I was a kid, and that eventually led me to write a book called Tornado God, American Religion and Violent Weather. And that's all about how Americans view violent weather through the lens of religion. But as I got into that project, I realized that you can't talk about violent weather events without also considering climate change. The question is the weather just something that happens to us, or is some of it made worse by our own actions? And so that's what leads into these questions of climate change. And of course, we've seen the evidence of climate change for the past couple of decades all around us. And so the more I got into this project, the more I realized that a significant chunk of the book would need to be about these climate debates.
It almost sounds like a chicken and egg scenario when you mention, is climate change caused by us, or is it done to us? So that's something, I guess nobody will ever have the real answers to that. But do you think religion plays a significant role in the public's perception of climate change issues?
Absolutely. And I think that that has always been true. I mean, the climate issue has only come onto people's radar in recent years for the most part. But in terms of how Americans view the weather, religion has always played a role. And that is ancient in human cultures. I mean, for as long as humans have been thinking religiously, they've been interpreting the weather through a religious lens. But with the settlement of American land by Europeans in colonial times, scientific perspectives began to challenge old religious perspectives about the weather. So throughout American history, we've seen kind of a tension between a scientific view of the weather that doesn't necessarily posit any kind of divine source of things, and a religious view that's ancient in human cultures. And, you know, we see storm gods across cultures, and this tendency to attribute weather events to divine causation. And so climate change focuses this issue more sharply. The question of what's caused by God and what's caused by humans or natural in some sense, and how do we separate all those out?
Mm-hmm. And Gabe, as someone who works in science, what are your thoughts on how religion plays a role in impacting people's beliefs on the climate crisis?
Well, I think it's really interesting, right? Because when I speak to groups, for example, on climate change and climate, I'm increasingly realizing that I cannot necessarily convince people about the severity of climate change through showing them another squiggly line plot of carbon dioxide rising year after year. I have to also talk to their hearts on these things. And religion, I think, plays a very powerful role in how people shape their worldview. One of my climate heroes is Catherine Hayhoe, and she's an evangelical Christian as well as a climate scientist. And she understands the fact that people relate to issues via stories. And I think religion provides us that way to storyify climate so that it's not a theoretical construct, but rather a part of their lived experience. And I think where Peter's brilliant on this is viewing this through the lens of weather. That's kind of how we perceive climate, really, is the weather. And I've increasingly used that term, changing weather, when I communicate with normal people, including in congregations.
That's interesting. So weather is a better term for folks to all come around versus saying climate change or global warming.
Well, certainly if I talk to a farmer in Indiana, I won't lead with the term climate change. I will start having a dialogue about what was the winter like when you were growing up here? What was the summer? How have you had to change any of your agricultural practices over the decades? And when I introduce that, they'll actually tell me a story of climate change. So I don't have to be in a position where I'm, you know, the professor lecturing them about climate change, which they heard on some media is not true. Instead, I'm actually engaging their lived experience.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about the basic science of climate change, Gabe. Can you give us some facts about what we already know and whether things are getting better or worse in the recent years?
Yes, we have known about the physics of climate change, what drives it, since about the 1850s or so, when Eunice Foote, the quote-unquote father of climate change science, she's actually a woman, advanced some of the first experiments on climate change. And the relationship is pretty clear. We know that there's these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They've always been there. And what they do is they absorb a little extra heat before it escapes out to outer space. And one of these greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide. And one of the products, byproducts of human activities, like the burning of fossil fuel, is this carbon dioxide. So just like in geologic time, whenever you have more of this gas in the atmosphere, the planet gets warmer. And so whether that gas is from natural sources, which it used to be, or whether it's from humans, which it is now, we're seeing just physics play out, right, in our weather. What's happened, interestingly, over the last couple of decades is that it's almost like it's turned up its volume control, climate has. There's a lot of natural sinks that have sort of absorbed some of that excess carbon that we've been emitting since the Industrial Revolution. They've acted to sort of ameliorate the worst impacts. Well, those sinks are all used up now. And I think that's why the last couple of decades we've seen such a substantial uptick in, for example, climate-related weather disasters. This culminating in this last summer where we had, you know, towns in British Columbia reaching, you know, 130 degrees and then catching fire, forest fires throughout the West, flooding in Europe, extreme hurricane impacts on the Gulf. So this is really, I think this decade is our decade of climate reckoning, to tell you the truth.
Speaking of the natural disasters and seeing an increase in climate-related weather disasters, Peter, do you think that's made it more difficult for folks who have beliefs that God will handle things to see this type of stuff happening?
I think that to some extent it is making it more difficult. I mean, one thing that we've seen is that the level of climate denialism, which is kind of a shorthand for denying that humans are causing global warming, the level of climate denialism among evangelical Protestants who have had the highest rate of denialism has gone down significantly in the past decade. About 10 years ago or so, polls seemed to indicate that about 20-some percent of evangelical Protestants thought that global warming, if they believed in it at all, was being caused by human activity. And now it's a recent poll showed that 44% of evangelical Protestants believe that humans are responsible for much of the global warming that we see. So I think things are changing, and yet religion still is a powerful influence on the way people think about weather, the climate, and the environment. And so I think that's why we still have to reckon with it. I mean, Gabe, I think, put it nicely that we're in a time of reckoning, and I think religious traditions have awakened that too, to that reality.
Do you think there's some sort of religious perspective that comes out of this fear of the unknown with the weather, I'm just thinking of my own religious traditions and how I've heard people in my community say, like, you know, this is a sign of the end of times. The more we're going to see this kind of natural disasters, it means the end of the world is near.
Well, sure. I mean, there's always going to be some element of apocalypticism mixed in with religious perspectives on weather and climate. That's a powerful tradition, particularly in Judeo-Christian traditions. This notion that the end of the world is near. Now, I mean, that can cut two ways. I mean, on the one hand, if you have a strongly apocalyptic view of things, you might be tempted to throw up your hands and say, well, if the end of the world is near, why bother with trying to work to save the planet? But then on the other hand, you can marshal an apocalyptic view to call people to action and say, look, the planet is burning and we need to do something. And so apocalypticism in that sense becomes a wake up call.
We're about to head to a quick break. Gabe, I wanted to just real quick ask you about the climate change in Glasgow. We can touch more about it after the break. What were your thoughts on that conference? Do you think it made any changes?
Well, I do think it did. I think that we saw more aggressive commitments from countries. I think that they were called out by youth activists who were protesting pretty heavily outside of the event, so much so that they ultimately did stiffen up some of their emission controls, and they're heading in the right direction. Having said that, it's not far enough. Most climate scientists know that, but it's at least an inkling that we're heading there, and hopefully these commitments will be able to hit some of these critical climate targets, which we can talk about after the break.
Yes, indeed, we will do that. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the role religion plays in the climate crisis. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the relationship between climate change and religion in America, and we'll get to a conversation about Christianity and climate denialism and how they've played a role in conversations and beliefs around the climate crisis. But we're going to pick up where we left off at the break, speaking about the climate, conference in Glasgow. We're joined now by Peter Tusen, professor of religious studies at IUPUI, and Gabe Filippelli, executive director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Gabe, you mentioned there wasn't really enough done in Glasgow. What do you think needs to be done?
One of the key aspects of some of these conversations at Glasgow, at these climate conferences, is to get firm commitments from countries on their emissions targets, right? And that means from coal and natural gas and gasoline, but also to provide a framework to providing support for those countries who do not have the financial capacity to scale things down, ramp down emissions as quickly as do some of the Western countries, right? And so two things usually go on at this climate conference. There's usually a call on the historical emitters, including the United States and Western Europe, to help provide some kind of support for the developing world to also have energy options, right? But then there's usually then a set of countries in the middle, China and India, huge emitters presently, who are notoriously slow at making the transition. So one of the things that ended up the last second kind of decision was a weakening of some of the language at that COP meeting in Glasgow, the climate meeting, such that coal wasn't going to be phased out at the end of 2030, which it really should be, but rather phased down. Out and down are two very different words. And so that was a great disappointment to a lot of people. But clearly, we've been having these climate conferences for decades now, and we keep seeing the amount of carbon dioxide emitted to our atmosphere continuing apace. We haven't had this much greenhouse gas in our atmosphere since probably about 6 million years ago. So a lot has to be done, basically, and it has to be done really quickly.
A lot of people end up fleeing their homes due to natural disasters, or there are conflicts between countries happening due to this displacement. Peter, what do you think that means, and how does this impact religion globally?
Well, there's an interesting new book on this. Philip Jenkins, who's a well-known historian of global Christianity, has argued in a new book called Climate, Catastrophe, and Faith that we're going to see actually an increase in religiosity in the coming years, partly because of climate change. But the kind of religiosity that we'll see is going to be a kind of fiery, combative, in some cases, religiosity that may pit the developing world against richer countries. Jenkins bases his argument on looking at the long history of the evolution of the climate and how past climate upheavals like the ice ages led to an uptick in religiosity, but often of a kind of militant nature. And so the picture is not pretty in terms of friendly relations among societies, nations, people of different religious faiths.
So it sounds like it's something that's cyclical throughout history, where something gets bad and then everybody bands together, but maybe they go a little overboard.
Go ahead.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, that is Jenkins's argument. I mean, and we know that the climate has changed over the millennia, and so that has had a social effect too. But I also want to emphasize, and Jenkins too emphasizes, that the kind of climate change that we're seeing now is on a different order in terms of not only its effect on the planet, but also its potential effect on social disruption and religious activity.
We do want to address a little bit about denialism. And so, Gabe, what is denialism in the context of climate change?
One of my favorite climate journalists, Mary Anais Hegler, has coined the term denialism, but that's with the nihilism in the middle, right? And so it's you can just simply say, well, this is too much, right? So this problem is too big, this kind of the apocalyptic view that that Peter mentioned earlier, and feel like, well, there's nothing you can do, you can throw in the towel. And the fossil fuel industries were using that quite a bit, that technique, and funding that technique quite a bit over the last decade. And now they've pivoted to another tactic, which is they ascribe it to your personal footprint, right? People think, well, what can I do to solve climate change, right? That's a question that I often get when I give talks about it. And clearly the most important thing you could do is talk about it or vote for climate change. Yes, you can do little things like change your diet or bike more and so forth, but we're not going to vegan ourselves out of this problem, because it's a systemic problem, right? It's the way our power is produced and the way our vehicles are fueled. And so I think it was either Exxon or Shell famously had this ad campaign this last year on Twitter. It was like, what is your climate footprint, right? And of course, they got drugged on Twitter by climate scientists saying, you know, you're asking us about our personal carbon footprint. You know, you've been orchestrated the destruction of our, you know, many of our planetary systems. So denialism has a long history, but it's the message has changed. They're very savvy groups of folks who create these messages, but it works. To tell you the truth, it works. I do talk to young people who just feel like what can I do? I have no options. What's the world going to look like? You know, whereas, you know, the other response is, I think Peter brought this up, is, or you can go up in arms about it, which is where I see the youth climate activists moving.
It is something that is tricky, because I even think about my own habits of trying to recycle or trying to use less of something or other. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, I see, for example, masks littered all over the street. And I'm like, what? I'm doing all this for what? Like, there's trash everywhere now.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, that is a challenging thing. I hopefully we learned a couple lessons during the pandemic. I don't think we're very good at learning lessons, but nevertheless, one of them is one statistic that was just, it struck me so hard, which is that during the middle of that shutdown, when everything ceased, right? There's no planes in the air, very few cars moving around. What did we do to change carbon emissions? Well, we only dropped them by 7% globally. So we shut down global society and only reduced our carbon emissions by 7%. Now, remember that in 9 years now, we have to have reduced our carbon emissions by 50% to meet climate targets. So that reduction of only that small percent, that 7%, tells you that 97% of our carbon emissions are cooked in on things that are not up to personal choice, right? You cannot choose to, you know, not fly or not commute. Well, both of those things were happening. That was the 7%. The other 93% is what was fueling our lights and our Zoom meetings.
Wow, that's really eye-opening. Peter, I know we talked earlier about how religion affected the way people view weather. How has religion affected the way people view climate? And is that different than how they view weather? Or is it the same thing?
Well, I think they're hard to separate, especially in the American context, because the weather looms so large for Americans. You know, I mean, I write about this most indigenous of American storms, the tornado, and, you know, everybody can remember major tornado disasters. For that matter, we can all remember major hurricanes. And so the weather is larger than life, so to speak, for Americans. And so that has tended to keep Americans focused on this old question that's been debated since colonial times. Is God directing these things? And, you know, especially when people are killed by the weather, you know, why did one person die and another person live? I mean, so enter then the climate problem. And I mean, people are still kind of on that channel of thinking about divine causation. But what I think climate has awakened people to is, maybe humans have a role to play in all of this too. I mean, I think it's becoming more and more accepted, for example, that hurricanes cause worse flooding. They're becoming more destructive because of human-induced climate change. And so this is shifting the focus to human initiative and human responsibility. And so I think what we've seen just in the last 5 or 10 years is a variety of religious traditions seeking resources within their traditions for thinking about human responsibility for the planet.
Would you say it's fair to say that most religions generally have favorable views towards the planet, leaving it better than they received it?
I think you can find important resources in all the major world religious traditions. I mean, there's this interesting debate, long-running debate now among historians and religion specialists about, you know, whether one religion is less environmentally friendly than another. In fact, there was a famous article in 1967 by a historian named Lynn White, and he argued that Christianity is the most human-centric religion, and this was not a compliment in his view. Most human-centric religion, I mean, it's grounded, first of all, in the notion that God grants humans dominion over the creation. That's in the first chapter of Genesis. But then more than Judaism, he argued, Christianity kind of set up a sharp divide between humans and nature and saw human destiny as spiritual and left nothing spiritual in nature, basically. His negative view of the influence of Christianity has been challenged in recent years. And I think what a lot of Christian theologians have come to realize is the Bible's full of resources that can be used to argue for climate care, because climate care really ultimately in the end is about caring for each other, for our fellow humans, and for our collective responsibility for the society. And so all religions have resources in that regard. The fact is that when ancient scriptures were written, no one was thinking about climate. And so you don't find a treatise on climate change in the Bible. So you have to use the Bible more creatively. And I think that's what theologians have really done in the last decade.
We have a listener voicemail from Marion who has a question about religion and animal agriculture. Let's take a listen.
This is Marion from Rochdale, Indiana. I would like to hear discussed animal agriculture with religion. On the very beginning of Genesis, God tells us that he created men in order to have dominion over fish and fowl and all creatures, but there is no certainty that God actually did grant man dominion over other creatures, especially when we consider them as property. Yet every religion seems to agree on the right to kill a deer or a cow and to treat chickens and other animals however we want, even on the most bloodiest of wars. So I would really like to hear religion stand on veganism, the moral obligation to the animals. Thank you.
All right. Peter, maybe we can address just what is the responsibility with religion and animal agriculture?
Well, that's a tough question because, I mean, within every religious tradition, you're going to find a variety of perspectives on that based on different readings of sacred texts very often. I mean, I think that it's an interesting question because the passage from Genesis that she was referencing, it has been so much debated in recent discussions of climate change, that notion that God granted humans dominion over the creation. I mean, a few years ago, Pope Francis issued an encyclical, Laudato Si, a major statement on climate change, and he talked about that, and he said, you know, we shouldn't read that apart from other passages that talk about our responsibility to care for the earth, to till and keep it, as the second chapter of Genesis says. And so I think there's been a recognition among a lot of Christians that Genesis 1 doesn't justify the mistreatment of the creations, and that would include mistreatment of animals. Now, whether it justifies or whether it calls for veganism is another question. But this is a legitimate question raised in our time. And I think I'm going to have to defer to those who have studied more directly the issue of animal rights and religion. And I should point out parenthetically that that's a growing area of scholarship. I'm just not the best person qualified to comment on it.
Yeah, that could probably be a whole other topic to dig into. Gabe, before we head to break, what does Indiana look like when it comes to climate change? Are we doing okay?
Indiana remains one of the highest emitters of carbon of all the states. It's in the top 10 list of that. So that's not a list that you want to be in the on the top of. But in terms of the projected climate impacts, we'll be dealing with a couple main ones. And that's what a lot of what we do with the Environmental Resilience Institute is about, is arming cities and towns to deal with climate that we expect and that we've already seen. So, you know, clearly it won't be the hurricanes or the forest fires. It's a very different type of climate change that we're going to have to deal with here in Indiana, even in the short term. And we've already seen climate changing in terms of a couple of these parameters. So yeah, we have our own unique flavor of climate change.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with experts on the role religion has played on the climate change process. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing the intersection of religion and climate change and the crisis in America. And we're joined now by Peter Tusin, professor of religious studies at IUPUI, and Gabe Filippelli, executive director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Gabe, before the break, we were talking about the climate change impact in Indiana. Do you think Hoosiers are aware of climate change as opposed to, like, let's say, other states? Are they motivated to do something about it?
We have a pretty good sense that Hoosiers are aware of climate change and are aware that humans are a principal driver of it. And that's because we've done a set of statewide surveys called the Hoosier Life Index. But we've analyzed people's response to some pretty nuanced questions. And clearly, there is a bit of a partisan divide between people who can fully ascribe climate change as human cause and those who are not sure. But it's well over 50% of Hoosiers, I think so, over 70%, in fact, who recognize climate change and climate change impacts. So I think it's now increasingly recognized as an issue. And I think it's becoming more so because people are seeing these climate change impacts playing out in real time. You know, so they're actually seeing the weather phenomenon. One of the ones that has been most striking and that will continue to increase in severity is extreme precipitation events, meaning big rainfalls, particularly in the spring and sometimes in the late summer, so in a couple different seasons. But what that's done is it's increasingly overwhelming cities' abilities to deal with stormwater systems, right? Plus it's overwhelming farmers' capacity to get a good set of corn crops in the spring. I think 2 years ago, we had such repeated rainfall. It wasn't necessarily heavy all the time, but it was so frequent that planting was pushed out really late, which meant the corn yields went down. So yes, and you know what's interesting is that, you know, the Environmental Resilience Institute works in towns that are Republican and Democrat, and some of the services we bring are calculations that our students do for the greenhouse gas inventories. This is where the city takes a full assessment of where their greenhouse gases are emitted from, you know, and ostensibly uses it to reduce electrical costs. But then we follow on the next year with a climate action plan and then help them implement this. So think about this. These are Republican rural small towns often, who we can freely use the word climate change in. So yes, things have changed, I think, because people are seeing flooding events, some extreme heat events and so forth. And they listen to the news, of course, and seeing what goes on outside of Indiana.
We have a question from Sarah on Facebook who asks, what do your speakers view as the link between the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor and marginalized? Would a changing attitude toward the people who are marginalized in our communities and who are more likely to be negatively impacted by climate change also change our attitudes toward how we engage with the aspects of our life that have the potential to reduce our impact on climate change? I don't know which one of you wants to take on the question.
Well, this is Peter. I would say to that I think that it absolutely that two things are connected, that our relationship to the poor and marginalized is central to attacking the climate change problem. In fact, you know, I'll reference the Pope again. His really important statement, his encyclical from 2015, Laudato Si, made the point that we can't have a sense of deep communion with the rest of nature if our hearts lack tenderness and compassion for our fellow human beings. And that especially means those who are marginalized or those societies that are being disproportionately affected by climate change. Climate change caused disproportionately by richer nations. So I would very much agree with the questioner that both are connected. And if I could, I would like to give a shout out in relation to that previous caller's question about humans and animals, or maybe I should say humans and non-human animals. My own colleague in religious studies at IUPUI, Andrea Jan, is working on that issue. And so I would just say stay tuned, because she has a documentary coming out eventually and more work having to do with that human, non-human animal relationship.
Well, Peter, I know we've talked about Christianity and its ties to climate change and such. Can you give us a breakdown on the religions that are prevalent around America right now? And, you know, I think Christianity is probably the top religion right now in the U.S., but I could be mistaken.
That's right. I mean, the society is still heavily Christian. I mean, around 70% or so Christian polls seem to indicate. And about a quarter of the American population, or maybe a little less, identifies as evangelical Protestant. And so I mentioned earlier that we find the highest rates of climate change denialism among evangelicals, although that denialism is decreasing. Non-Christians account for maybe 6% or so of the U.S. population. And then unaffiliated persons, religiously unaffiliated persons, are at least 23%, maybe 24-25%. We actually seem to see the highest rate of concern about climate change among religiously unaffiliated persons. And so that in itself is interesting and something that I think religion scholars are still reckoning with.
Do you think there was a connection at all, Peter, between Trump supporters, evangelical Protestants, and the climate crisis? Is there anything related there?
Sure. I mean, in the Trump administration, we saw a kind of alliance form between evangelical deniers and those who were intent on deregulation, and those came together in the person of Scott Pruitt, whom Trump appointed as his first EPA director. Pruitt was an evangelical Protestant and a climate change skeptic, and he had previously been Attorney General of Oklahoma and was known as an anti-regulatory crusader in Oklahoma, fought all kinds of regulation, even fought against mandating tornado shelters in public schools. And so when Pruitt became head of the EPA, he set about to try to kind of dismantle the regulatory function of this agency that was supposed to be dedicated to regulation that would be climate friendly. And Pruitt, of course, eventually resigned in disgrace after a financial scandal, but that evangelical Protestant influence on climate policy continued in the Trump administration. And so it was only with the election of Joe Biden that we saw basically a complete reversal in government policy on that issue.
Gabe, what was the impact of the Trump administration on America's involvement with addressing climate change? Did it push us back?
It certainly did push us back. One of the impacts was optics, right? Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, or climate agreement, which we obviously are back in again. So optics matter on the international front. And as Peter mentioned, the administration is behind the attempted dismantling of all of the regulatory pieces that are behind reducing carbon emissions, including some incentives, right, for renewables and so forth. But it ultimately wasn't very successful because aspects of the administration were quite inept in the way that they went about trying to pull these laws, and fortunately laws take a while to reverse. So I'd say rather than throwing us backwards, it just kept us static and churning while climate change was proceeding apace, right? And so we certainly were doing little proactively. Now, does that matter a lot? It's a good question. When we see the fact that renewables have exploded across the U.S., even in the active Trump administration, one could argue that, it looks like business is making its own decision on some of these things. And that's great. But by saying exploded, it is still just a very small bit of our energy mix in the U.S. So what the infrastructure bill has in it, the one that just passed, is actually some funding for a whole lot of climate resilience, as well as a build out of electrical vehicle charging stations. But the next infrastructure bill, which is still in negotiations, used to have this double-edged attack on fossil fuel emitters, right? It was incentives for renewable energy to be paid for by fines, effectively, against fossil fuel emitters. It wasn't, they don't call them fines, but that was how it was going to be a budget neutral kind of event. Well, unfortunately, the carrot stayed in, but the stick has not stayed in. So it's going to be difficult to see how that will eventually work out. But local organizations and local agencies and local businesses are doing a lot of this themselves. But it certainly does help when you have an administration over you that is at least not putting potholes in the road in front of you, right? They're actually helping pave the road so that we have these solutions implemented across Indiana and across the country.
Peter, when it comes to the religious aspect of the involvement of religion and climate change, do you see that similar thing happening outside of the U.S., or is this just something unique to Americans?
I do see it happening outside of the U.S. Now, I'm a specialist in American religion, but I think one thing that is happening in all the major world religious traditions is a growing sense of globalism, of global responsibility, global solutions to problems, especially climate change. And so beginning around 2015, there was a flurry of statements on the issue of climate change issued by major world religious organizations, in some cases ecumenical organizations, interfaith organizations, but sometimes they were gatherings of leaders from different regions of the world from within a particular religious tradition. And so there really has been a tremendous amount of attention to this issue, and I do see that as a global phenomenon.
One question that I think a lot of people have on their minds when it comes to religion and climate change is that if people believe God created the world, why don't they feel compelled to protect it? Is there anything behind that on what causes that?
Yeah, I mean, why do people not feel a greater sense of responsibility if God created the world? Yeah, I mean, that's been the resounding question that I religious climate activists have been asking. And I mean, I think, you know, back to the American context, I think there's been a reluctance among a lot of Americans to give up the view that God will take care of everything. I mean, it's become kind of infamous now, but there was this incident a few years back when Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe, who wrote a book called The Greatest Hoax, which was denied that human-induced climate change was happening, when he brought a snowball onto the floor of the Senate and said, look, it's really cold outside, so this seems to argue against global warming. But, I mean, his whole logic was God will take care of things. God, after the flood in Genesis, promised not to do that to the earth again. And, you know, it's kind of easy to mock that view. But on the other hand, if you believe in an all-powerful God, you want to believe that God won't leave humans defenseless. And so, you know, I can see the logic of it too. And so I think that's been a hard thing for religious people, especially Christians in America, to give up and to realize that maybe humans bear a huge responsibility that that a lot of people didn't fully realize.
Well, speaking of our responsibility, Gabe, as we get ready to wrap up here, what can we do now? Especially if we feel like, can we even do any reversal to what's the damage that's already been done?
Well, we can certainly reduce or slow the continued rate of climate change, and we could do that right now. It's just a question of weaning ourselves aggressively off of fossil fuels. So we have to, what I like to say is we have to turn off the spigot first before we clean up the mess. The spigot is the carbon emissions. I'm really leery of various, I call them tech bros, but these geoengineering solutions, quote unquote solutions, that promise that we can continue emitting and then, you know, some Elon Musk of the world will invent something to fix us, to bail us out. Well, there's a lot easier way to do that, which is we know what's causing climate change, carbon emissions. And so we know how to reduce the future severity of climate change, which is turn off the spigot. And then we'll deal with cleaning up the mess later on.
Thank you both for joining us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure. Peter Tucson is a professor of religious studies at IUPUI, and Gabe Filippelli is the executive director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.